It is Sunday, July 12th, UTC, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, top diplomats of the world's major powers and Iran prepare for a potential last day of talks to try to reach a nuclear deal. Hopes of another deal for Greece, whose prime minister met his fellow European leaders hoping to secure an economic bailout that keeps his country in the Eurozone.
We owe that to the peoples of Europe, who wants Europe united and not divided. We can reach an agreement tonight if all parties want it.
And we'll round up the tennis action from the final weekend of Wimbledon. That's all ahead on International Edition. For more than 2 weeks, international journalists have been camped outside the Iran nuclear talks in Austria's capital, awaiting word of a possible deal between Tehran and six world powers. On Sunday, a day before the negotiators faced a fourth self-imposed deadline for this round of talks, some diplomats told the journalists that a deal was close. But a senior U.S. official also went on the record as saying major issues still had to be resolved. Well, VOA's Heather Murdoch is one of those journalists monitoring the discussions in Vienna, and earlier I asked her what major obstacles remain to an agreement.
Well, they don't tell us exactly what the major issues are, but there's been a couple of sticking points from the beginning with these negotiations. So we presume that the issues involve the possible inspections of Iran's military sites and also the timing of sanctions relief. Another issue that's come up recently, though, is the arms embargo, where Iran has asked for a lift of the arms embargo, and the Western countries are very much against this.
Why are those Western countries opposed to lifting that arms embargo?
Because one of the major reasons they're having these talks in the first place is a fear of a conflict between Iran and the United States. So they don't want to have more weapons flowing into Iran or Iran selling more weapons, especially because they suspect Iran of supporting militant groups all over the Middle East, some of which Iran says they support, like Hezbollah. Others they don't admit openly, like the Houthis in Yemen and other various groups in Syria.
And why do the Iranians make such a big deal out of getting the arms embargo lifted?
Well, I think that it's just for Iran, you know, as a sovereign country, it doesn't want other countries to be telling it what it can buy and what it can sell, and they stand to make, you know, quite a bit of money in arms sales.
What do observers of the talks there in Vienna think about all of these deadlines for the negotiations that keep coming and going? Are they getting more cynical, or do they think that the next deadline will be the last?
Well, a lot of the observers, by the way, here at the talks are here not just observing, but in support of the talks. So a lot of them will play down the missing of the deadlines and saying, forget the deadline, let's just get it done. It does worry some people that it's continuing to go on, but there's a lot of hope that this deadline is the final one.
So how challenging is it to cover a process like this with so much uncertainty about the time frame for the talks and, you know, who's involved in these negotiations at any one time, given the fact that you have people coming and going constantly?
It is kind of a frustrating story to report. You know, you have to change your plans all the time, and then there's a lot of hurry up and wait because there's very little information. So, you know, I have to create tons of reports on without new information. And so a lot of speculation goes into the story. So that's difficult. Last time when we were reporting it in Switzerland, it was very similar, although there was more information coming from diplomats then than now. And it was frustrating, and the journalists were exhausted and tired and sick of missing the deadlines by the time they finally came up with something. But what they did come up with was so interesting and so huge, you know, that it was kind of worth it in the end as a journalist to cover it.
And I guess here's hoping that something similar could happen here in this case.
Well, we're hoping something happens.
Right, so that you can file your stories and then move on to the next one. But thanks very much, Heather Murdoch in Vienna.
Thank you.
Well, let's have a look now at what social media are saying about the Iran nuclear talks. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio for a look at some of the latest tweets. G, what have you found?
Hi, Michael. Like Heather just mentioned, it looks like wrapping up this round of talks by tonight is going to be pretty tough. Here's what an official with the Iranian Foreign Ministry tweeted earlier today. We're working hard, but a deal tonight is simply logistically impossible. This is a 100-page document after all. The Iranian Foreign Ministry's counselor is on Twitter at Mir Youssefi, that's MIRYOUSEFI. I also wanted to mention that VOA's Victoria Maki did a story on the negotiators possibly pushing the announcement of a final deal to Monday. A reader from Houston, Texas named Lawrence Bush wrote in the comments section, "Delays are acceptable, but not any loopholes in the final nuclear settlement with Iran." That reader added, "A nuclear agreement doesn't necessarily mean that Washington will normalize ties with Tehran."
Well, gee, what have the top nuclear negotiators for the U.S. and Iran been tweeting about the talks?
Well, just a few of them have been tweeting. The U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, wrote he met with Federica Mogherini, who is a vice president of the European Union, as well as the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Kerry added they are still having difficult issues to resolve. You know, his tweets are always very diplomatic, as one might expect from a country's top diplomat.
Not surprising.
But his Iranian counterpart, Zarif, usually writes more dynamic tweets, but he hasn't been tweeting since Thursday.
Kind of quiet, huh?
Mm-hmm. Mogherini, who is also the high representative of the EU for foreign affairs and security policy, tweeted, "All EU team at work on hashtag Iran talks, decisive hours."
Yes, the final hours. So how much attention are these talks getting on social media?
Well, during the past day, hashtag Iran Talks Vienna was used more than 12,000 times, and hashtag Iran Talks was used just as much, with nearly 12,000 tweets using the hashtag. That's according to the social media analytics website Topsy. Michael?
All right. Well, thanks for bringing us up to date. That was G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Here in Washington, U.S. lawmakers will soon begin an August recess that stops work in both congressional chambers for an entire month. Those lawmakers are now under pressure to make progress on a whole series of issues ahead of that recess, such as government spending on the U.S. military and domestic programs. Our congressional correspondent, Michael Bowman, joins me for a look at those issues. Michael, what do Republicans and Democrats say they want to focus on in the coming weeks?
Republicans very much want to boost the level of military spending. They argue that with the terrorist threats, with various, you know, global security concerns, that the sequester-level funding for the military, basically automatic across-the-board budget cuts, don't make sense in our current national security environment, and they really want to expand that. The problem is that there is a law, which is sequester. And so year by year, all government spending is supposed to be whittled away by the same amount. And they're trying to come up with some rather creative ideas. There is a contingency fund for overseas operations. And Republicans are thinking, well, maybe just for this year, we can dip into that fund and move some of the money over into the military budget.
Well, what do the Democrats think about that idea?
They say that if we're going to be increasing government spending, that it shouldn't just be the military that benefits, that all Americans and all programs have a rationale, and that there should be some balance between national security and domestic programs.
So with those domestic programs, which are the most important for the Democrats?
I suppose that depends on the Democrat that you ask.
Okay.
Democrats very much want to see a focus on the kinds of programs that are broadly popular with the middle class and for infrastructure programs and spending of that sort. And, you know, there's really a wild card in all of this. Here we are approaching the month of August when Congress typically takes the entire month off. So you can erase Congress. I mean, the halls of Congress will be quiet for 4 weeks. And we have this possibility of a nuclear deal with Iran, which, if it goes before Congress, will get a vote in both chambers of Congress if they decide to vote on it. There will be a review period. There will be officials from the administration hauled up to Capitol Hill to talk about it. And all of this will consume time. And there's only so much time that Congress has to deal with all these domestic fiscal things that are piling up.
Right. So it looks like those will kind of sink down the priority list.
One would think so,
supposedly.
But the government has to be funded. I mean, the Republicans do not want on their watch to have another government shutdown. They want to go into next year's presidential election saying, we can govern, we can do the nation's business, we can handle this, we are up to the task. And if the United States suffers another government shutdown, if things are in disarray, broadly speaking, from a fiscal standpoint, that really doesn't look good for them.
Okay, well, let's hope there isn't a government shutdown, because that could affect us here, too, at the Voice of America.
Indeed, it could.
But thanks very much, Michael Bowman, our congressional correspondent. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Eurozone leaders met on Sunday in Brussels for what some observers described as last-chance talks to find a solution to the Greek financial crisis or risk economic chaos for Athens and possibly a messy exit from the Eurozone. Here's our report from Lisa Bryant.
With just hours to reach some sort of an agreement on the fate of Greece, leaders of the 19-member Euro currency union framed the talks in dramatic terms. Heading into the Brussels summit, European Union President Jean-Claude Juncker said he would fight until the last millisecond to reach a deal that keeps Greece in the Eurozone. French President François Hollande offered similar comments.
L'enjeu, c'est savoir si la Grèce sera demain dans la zone euro. Mais l'enjeu, c'est l'Europe.
At stake, Mr. Hollande said, was not simply whether Greece would remain in the Eurozone, but the very conception and interests of Europe. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said Athens is ready for what he called an honest compromise.
We owe that to the peoples of Europe, who wants Europe united and not divided. We can reach an agreement tonight if all parties want it.
But German Chancellor Angela Merkel was much more skeptical about the chances of reaching a deal.
So wie es aussieht, werden wir von der Eurogruppe noch kein einmütiges Papier bekommen.
She said the most important currency, trust and reliability, had been lost, adding that any deal reached must ensure the advantages outweigh the disadvantages for the future of Greece, the Eurozone, and EU cooperation. At issue is coming up with a workable plan for resuming bailout negotiations with Greece. Greece is teetering on bankruptcy and must make a nearly $3.4 billion payment to the European Central Bank on July 20th. Members of Mr. Tsipras' Syriza party angrily claim Greece is being humiliated. The heads of state were meeting after hours of tough discussions by their finance ministers, but they appear to have made some headway. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists say that they recently found proof that there are a number of hidden supermassive black holes in the universe. Using NASA's Nuclear Spectroscopic Telescope Array, or NuSTAR, satellite observatory, the researchers detected high-energy X-rays from five supermassive black holes that had been blocked from direct view by dust and gas. The astronomers say that their findings back a theory that suggests the existence of possibly millions of these supermassive black holes throughout the universe that are hidden from view. The five previously hidden black holes also appear to be much brighter and more active than had been previously thought. The researchers admit that without the New Star Satellite Observatory, it would have been nearly impossible to make the observations that uncovered the supermassive black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Novak Djokovic has successfully defended his Wimbledon men's singles title, defeating Roger Federer on Sunday. VOA sports editor Park Brewer is here for more on that. Park?
Well, indeed, it was Novak Djokovic, as you said, the great Serbian player who's ranked number one in the world, winning his third Wimbledon title in 5 years. And, you know, it was great to see him once again face off against Switzerland's Roger Federer. They played last year in a great final that went five sets. This time it went four sets. Again, very closely fought. The first two were tiebreakers in which Djokovic won the first one 7-6, and then Federer came back to win the next one 6-7. That one in the tiebreaker point went 12 points to 10.
So that's a long one.
That's a long one. Yeah. And then, of course, Djokovic closed him out 6-4, 6-3. Federer just continues to amaze me. This is a guy that is aged 33 years old, still playing at the top of his game. He's won all these Grand Slam tournaments in his career. Could have called it quits, you know, two, three years ago.
But he keeps going.
He just keeps going. It's amazing. But Djokovic knew, you know, back when Federer was winning all these titles and Rafael Nadal of Spain as well, that he had to lift his game to be able to compete. And he's done so and just playing great tennis right now.
Yeah, but Federer has won so many Wimbledon titles, which is why he keeps coming back and trying to defend. I mean, do you think we're seeing kind of the end of an era with Federer now and Djokovic just taking over?
Well, I think Federer has said he wants to keep playing as long as he's having fun. I think we'll see him out on the court as long as he can keep getting to Grand Slam finals. You never know. He could break through in one of these.
Right. And
it'd be nice to see if he could do it.
On the women's side, on Saturday, we had Serena Williams of the U.S. again winning Wimbledon, and she is in her early 30s. How long is she going to keep going?
Well, you know, she's 33, just like Roger Federer, and this is her second what they call so-called Serena Slam, where she's won the U.S. Open, then the first three major titles of the next year, Australian, French, and then Wimbledon. You know, she faced this young 21-year-old from Spain, Gabina Muguruza, in her first ever Grand Slam title, put up a good fight. It was 6-4, 6-4. Kind of was back and forth for a while there. Even Serena led 5-1 in the second set. And Gabina didn't give up. She came back and, you know, gave her all she could handle, I think, in this one. So she knew about it. But the thing about Serena now, she does have a chance to make the Grand Slam in one calendar year.
I think she wants to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It hasn't been done since Steffi Graf of Germany back in 1988. Graf also has 22 majors, and Serena has 21. So it's so coincidental that she could do the Slam and tie Graf at the same time.
So extra motivation there. And just before we close out here, another veteran at Wimbledon also achieving success. And we're talking about
Martina Hingis of Switzerland.
Right.
Go figure. Here's a woman that doesn't play singles anymore, but at age 34, she wins two doubles titles at Wimbledon. Not only the women's title, which she won yesterday with India's Sonia Mirza, her first ever Grand Slam title. And then another Indian she wins the mixed doubles title with, Leander Paes, who actually plays team tennis right here in the nation's capital for the Washington Castles. He'll be here this summer and not too long from now.
Looking forward to that. So Park Brewer, thanks so much for that update.
My pleasure.
The lovable Minions from the Despicable Me movies now have their own full-length animated film. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Minions stars the voices of some of Hollywood's finest.
The film from Illumination Entertainment, the creators of the Despicable Me franchise, starts at the dawn of time and follows the Minions as they evolve through the ages, trying to find and to serve the worst of the worst.
Finding a master was easy.
La piñata!
Keeping a master. That's where things got tricky.
The film includes the voice of John Hamm, the star of the long-running, award-winning television show Mad Men. Hamm voices Herb Overkill, the husband of Oscar winner Sandra Bullock's supervillain, Scarlett Overkill. Hamm says that the arc of this story intrigued him.
Exploring who these guys are through history was
was a really kind of inspired choice, and then having them land in this really fun, funny time period that also happened to be relatively interesting to me was kind of cool.
The time period is 1968, when the Minions, Stuart, Kevin, and Bob, are headed to the Villain Con in Orlando, Florida, a convention of the worst villains around. And Bullock's Scarlet Overkill is the star of the show. She eventually gets Stuart, Kevin, and Bob to try to steal Queen Elizabeth's crown, but they soon find out that they have to save all of Minion kind from annihilation. The Minions hitch a ride with a seemingly innocent couple, Walter and Madge Nelson, voiced by Oscar nominee Michael Keaton and Golden Globe nominee Allison Janney. Janney has a special connection with the little yellow Minions in their blue overalls. She went to college with their creator.
I went to college with Chris Meledandri, who's the head of Illumination, who did all the Despicable Me's and the Minions, and so a dear friend, and he asked me to join the cast of Minions, and I was so completely honored and excited. And then I saw who I'd be voicing, the character of Madge, who was just deliciously, wonderfully evil in a not so evil package, in a very 1950s housewife package.
Allison Janney says that she regrets that in doing the animated film, she and Michael Keaton were never in the same room because their voice parts were recorded at different times.
But I only wish I'd gotten to be in the same room with Michael Keaton when we played these characters, because I didn't. I saw him get out of a limo without going to a pre-Oscar party, and he goes, "There's my wife." And I looked behind me. I was like, "Who are you?" And I realized he was talking to me. I'd forgotten that he had been cast as my husband, because we never got to act together.
For actor John Hamm, the project was something new after the end of Mad Men nearly 1 year ago.
It's been a fun year, you know? It's been a little work and a little vacation and then kind of a lot of press, because then the stuff starts coming out and we have to talk about it and tell people about it. So it's been fun. It certainly has not been a traditional unemployment period, I'll put it that way.
Minions also stars Oscar winner Jeffrey Rush as the narrator. Oscar nominee Steve Carell voices the young Gru, the villain that the Minions later work for in the Despicable Me films. Oscar nominee Stephen Coogan, currently the star of Showtime's Happy-ish, provides the voice of Professor Flux and the Tower Guard. The soundtrack features hit music from the 1960s, including Revolution by the Beatles, You Really Got Me by the Kinks, and Jimi Hendrix's Foxy Lady as Scarlet Overkill's theme song. I'm David Byrne.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. We're on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm at Michael_Lippin. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department prepares detailed reports assessing respect for human rights around the world. The reports, required by law, evaluate how the governments of every country and a number of territories demonstrate respect for human dignity and individual freedoms. Lawmakers, as well as authorities in the executive branch, use the reports to help shape our nation's foreign policies. They also signal to the human rights defenders and activists under siege that our government recognizes their struggle and stands with them. There has been some improvement in the human rights picture in Vietnam, but many concerns remain. The most significant human rights problems there were severe government restrictions on citizens' political rights, particularly their right to change their government through free and fair elections, limits on citizens' civil liberties, including freedom of assembly and expression, and inadequate protection of citizens' due process rights, including protection against arbitrary detention. On January 1st, the President signed and promulgated significant amendments to the Constitution, including a dedicated chapter on human rights. And the government is debating the legal reforms to implement laws to reflect these constitutional changes. We understand that every country, including the United States, has room to improve on human rights. We are committed to the work of advancing universal rights, building the partnerships that will move us forward, helping every man, woman, and child live up to their potential. We will continue to work with the Vietnamese government and people to advocate for greater respect for human rights in Vietnam. In cases of nations such as Vietnam, we are also committed to speaking out for those unable to do so for themselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.